they're definite, then they would lose the effect of giving hope to the people.
Okay.
In the narrations, we have maybe more than 10 or 20 signs which are called as the indefinite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Okay.
If all of them were called definite by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, it would make people disappointed because they say that, okay, all of them are among the indefinite signs and we need to wait for all of them to happen one by one, and they lose just hope in the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Okay.
That is why we have a group of the signs which are definite and a group of signs which are indefinite.
All right.
On the other hand, the question is that, so why all of them are not definite? But if all the signs were indefinite, it means that bada may happen for all of them.
Yes.
Again, in that case, people would have problem.
Okay.
Because they say that, okay, this sign may have bada happen for that. The same is the case for the other sign. So if all the signs are going to be indefinite, people would, they are not going to be guided through the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And this is the philosophy of us having these two categories of definite signs and indefinite signs.
Thank you so much for providing us so great information. We'll discuss these signs that are definite one by one in another session, inshallah. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, any comments, please feel free to write us at englishradio@irib.ir. In case you want to search us on social media platforms, just type Call of Islam Radio. And in case you want to listen to our previous programs and this program again, you can log on to our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to the tab Call of Islam and you will find our programs over there. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Palestinian women. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%, and the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalists syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here, in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist's mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big that I was a mother and studying and working the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of Al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I save for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training on documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting, it had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive. And sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that are against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work in all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The latest U.S. nuclear strategy, together with its related policies and plans, will definitely have a seriously negative impact on global strategic security and stability, the strategic security relationship among major powers, as well as on the international and multinational nuclear arms control, disarmament, and non-proliferation processes. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported Washington's updated nuclear energy hypes up major power competition and alleged foreign threats, Beijing said. China has said that any attempts at nuclear blackmail by the United States will fail, accusing Washington of encouraging confrontation after it issued its latest nuclear posture review, NPR. asked about the recently published document which lays out U.S. nuclear weapons policies, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said DNPR smacks heavily of Cold War and zero-sum mentality and uses nuclear weapons as tools to advance the U.S. geopolitical agenda. Wang told reporters, adding that the United States has a specifically tailored a nuclear deterrence strategy against Beijing, I need to stress that in this latest NPR, the U.S. has made irresponsible remarks and accusations as well as groundless speculations on China's normal modernization of its nuclear forces. The new U.S. strategy, a declassified version of which was published recently, breaks with campaign promises made by President Joe Biden, leaving the door open for a nuclear response to a non-nuclear attack. While Biden has insisted the sole purpose of America's nuclear arsenal is to deter or retaliate against the first use of the bomb, the White House-approved NPR concluded that such an approach would result in an unacceptable level of risk in light of the range of non-nuclear capabilities being developed and fielded by the competitors. Wang went on to say that the updated American policy lowers the threshold for using nuclear weapons, while at the same time hyping up the so-called nuclear threat from certain countries. The U.S. has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world and continues to upgrade its nuclear triad and selectively advances the international nuclear arms control process only when doing so serves to suppress the countries it sees as rivals, he continued, adding, what's behind the U.S. policy is its hegemonic logic of seeking absolute military superiority, which could stoke a nuclear arms race. The Biden administration has repeatedly declared China to be Washington's top competitor and for most concern, with the Pentagon saying Beijing poses the most comprehensive and serious challenge to the U.S. national security in its new national defense strategy, also published recently alongside the new NPR and a missile defense review. Tensions have spiked between the two powers since August when U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan despite loud objections from Beijing, which sees the island as part of its own territory. Though the trip promoted an unprecedented round of Chinese military drills in the air and water surrounding Taiwan, Western delegations have nonetheless continued to visit Taipei in the months since, with Germany sending lawmakers on a junket there earlier this week. Meanwhile, China Daily reported Chinese Ambassador for Disarmament Affairs Li Song blasted the newly released Nuclear Posture Review NPR of the U.S. regime. In his remarks at a plenary meeting of the First Committee of the UN General Assembly, Li said the NPR reveals how the U.S., with its nuclear weapons in hand, observes the world and deals with other countries. He said this document hypes up major power competition and bloc confrontation, which reflects the logic of hegemonism seeking absolute military superiority. This is clearly against the world's desire to prevent nuclear war and avoid a nuclear arms race. The latest U.S. nuclear strategy, together with its related policies and plans, will definitely have a complex, far-reaching, and negative impact on global strategic security and stability. The strategic security relationship among major powers, as well as on the international and multinational nuclear arms control. In this NPR, the U.S. regime has made irresponsible remarks and accusations, as well as groundless speculation on China's normal modernization of its nuclear forces. It has brazenly tailored a nuclear deterrence strategy against China. Lee said, "We urge the U.S. not to assess China in the hegemonistic way that the U.S. behaves itself and imagine other countries as rivals or adversaries." Lee noted that China has the capability and confidence in safeguarding its national security interests, and that China will not be intimidated by the nuclear blackmail of the U.S. regime. "We urge the U.S. to abandon the Cold War mentality and the logic of hegemonism, pursue a rational and responsible nuclear policy, fulfill its special and primary responsibility in nuclear disarmament, and play its due role in maintaining global strategic stability and world peace and security."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Well, we are still at the presence of Sheikh Javid, and we are talking about hijab, just like a couple of episodes ago that we started this important subject. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to ask you about a face covering. What is the legal status or the religious law about wearing a face veil? Is it obligatory for women, actually, to obey the orders of their husbands and fathers in covering their faces?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is obligatory for a woman to cover her body other than her face and hands. We know it very well because a woman cannot cover her face and walk in the streets. And the same is the case. She needs to use her hands in order to do things, to work in,
right.
For example, to deal with other people. So the face and the hands up to the wrist are exempted. They are exceptions.
Right.
And the rulings regarding hijab, the rulings regarding the modest covering is clear, but it is important, according to religious scholars, that the circumstances should be taken into consideration, the circumstances in which a woman lives. And it should be carefully considered. She should avoid, in fact, wearing the dress of fame, the dress of fame. You know, according to Islamic Sharia, the dress of fame, you know, that it's a dress that makes you stand out among other.
To be noticeable and conspicuous.
Yeah, noticeable, it is flashy, and it's called libasi shuhra, okay? So it makes you, you know, quite noticeable among other women. So Islam is strictly opposed to wearing such clothing.
Yes.
And it does not make any difference whether a man wears such dress or a woman wears it. So when it is eye-catching, when it is flashy, one should not wear it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Some clothes may be very much eye-catching, very much flashy in one community, in one society, and the same clothes may not attract any attention in another society.
Right.
So it might be the libas-e-shuhra or the dress of fame in one country, and it may not be the same in another country.
Mm-hmm. Just following this point that you raised in an answer to the previous question that I asked you, about the dress of fame, right?
Yeah.
As you rightly mentioned, that in some countries, one dress may not be that much attractive, right, in comparison with the other geographical places or countries. So just following up this line of, let's say, reasoning, in some countries, some people cover their faces, right?
Yes.
So is it permissible for a woman in a conservative society like these, like those countries where they cover their face, to uncover her face?
Of course, according to Islamic Sharia, covering the face is not mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
Islam also does not object to women who cover their faces. According to some scholars, as far as I know, covering the face is recommended, covering the face for women. But Islam does not impose this practice on women.
Right.
And therefore women are allowed to choose not to cover their faces. And so if a woman chooses not to cover her face, she is not to blame. Even if all other women start covering their faces, and they are actually, it is the tradition of the community or the tradition of the people in the society, the custom for the woman to cover their faces. But if a woman chooses not to cover, she is not to blame and she is not sinful. She can continue not covering her face.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still our guest speaker, and the subject is hijab. Well, Sheikh Javid, I've been asking you questions about hijab, and you also mentioned that, this Islamic dress code, in fact, addresses, certain parts of the body, right? Not all, like the faces, for example, or the hands.
Yeah.
Right? But what about the neck? Is the neck area part of this Islamic dress code or hijab?
Of course. The neck must be covered by the woman, and even the lower part of the chin must be covered. And it's a matter of consensus among religious scholars. They are all agreed on this fact that the neck must be covered.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we see in some Muslim countries, unfortunately, either because of a lack of knowledge of religious teachings, religious laws, women, most of the women I see do not cover their necks, and they just walk out in the streets. And of course, it is just something normal for some ladies. But in some other countries, like some, for example, I didn't want to mention the names of those countries. Of course, there are some Muslim countries in which where not only cover their necks and chins, but they also cover their faces. So neck is, to put it in a nutshell,
mm-hmm.
neck is part of the hijab and it must be covered.
I see. Okay, and how about the religious law about socks? You said their feet should be covered, right?
Yeah.
So what is the ruling on a woman wearing, for example, a special type of socks, like, for example, thin pattern, colorful socks?
It is, according to scholars, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, forbidden for a woman to show her adornments, you know. And the adornments is not something, you know, one applies like in like lotion, like, for example, mascara or something like that. It can be in the form of socks. Now, it is forbidden for a woman to show her adornments whatsoever to non-mahram. It's haram to let a non-mahram, you know, see a woman's, you know, adornments. And it can come in, the adornments can be in the form of clothes, it can be in the form of socks. And if the socks are, you know, attractive, they are catching the attention of the men outside the woman's family, then she must not wear them, or she must cover them with something.
Mm-hmm, I see. A very quick question, Sheikh. You know, some girls wear newly designed or stylish dresses, right?
Yeah.
And in light of this, they go out wearing abaya and a veil, wearing these stylish clothes only in a family setting or situation or in front of their friends, even though these designs are often worn by unveiled women. So what's the religious law about wearing them?
Well, it is obligatory for a woman, according to what Allah Almighty says and what the Messenger of Allah has said, and also the infallible Imams have commanded, to cover all parts of the body. Mm-hmm. It's for a woman, I'm speaking about a woman covering her body, you know. So it is necessary for a woman to cover her head, to cover her hair, except her face and hands from the sight of men. Of course, this is something we repeatedly are saying it. And as for how to cover up, that is the question. It is up to the woman herself, you know, to choose how to cover herself. But it is necessary that the dress she wears is not see-through, it's not transparent, and it should not reveal her attractive parts, okay? Her attractive parts. That the cloth must be loose, it should not be,
tight.
You know, tight or close-fitting, and therefore it should not be, the dress she wears must not lure men, you know, and cause men to be sexually aroused somehow, and that's the point. Everyone understands, you know. Every woman knows that whether the clothes she wears is of this nature or not. Does it attract men or women, or it doesn't? So if it does, she must not wear it.
Mm-hmm. So, yes. In plain terms, she don't have to actually look hot.
Yeah, of course. Let me say it in just one sentence: the clothes she wears must not be see through.
Yeah,
it must not be tight. It should not be revealing,
mm-hmm.
and it should be loose.
Yes,
and it should not show the attractive parts of her body.
Okay, thank you very much, Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.